To hear a most eminent speaker, Professor Patricia Baird. We'll take next week's announcement off.
The red phone right there.
Right. Thanks to our organizer, Professor Peter Nemetz. Glories of modern technology. And technology is the subject of this evening's talk. Professor Baird was appointed by the former Prime Minister in October 1989 to head the Royal Commission on New Reproductive Technologies. She is a pediatrician, receiving her medical degree from McGill University in Montreal and her fellowship in pediatrics in 1968. She specialized in medical genetics and joined the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia, where she was head of the Department of Medical Genetics for over a decade until 1989. During her tenure as head, the department grew to have an outstanding reputation for combining activities in research and clinical care in an exemplary way. She was extensively involved both in developing services for parents and children with genetic diseases, as well as developing research into genetics. The author of more than 250 papers and abstracts, Dr. Baird's own research work is widely recognized and has focused on the distribution and natural history of birth defects and genetic diseases in the population. She has contributed to knowledge about the incidence and clinical course of Down syndrome and neural tube defects, for example. Her work has also focused on bioethical questions, including the issues of allocation of resources and delivery services. She was consultant to the Adoption Placement Section of the BC Department of Human Resources, as well as to the Health Surveillance Registry of the British Columbia Ministry of Health for many years. She has been member of several national bodies, among them the National Advisory Board on Science and Technology, the Medical Research Council of Canada, the Standing Committee on Ethics and Experimentation of the MRC, the Research Council of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, and the Ethics Panel of the International Pediatric Association. Dr. Baird was appointed Vice President of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research in February of 1991. She is a member of the Population Health Group of that institute, a multidisciplinary group whose work has been very influential in shaping how health and its determinants are viewed by policymakers and analysts in Canada. Dr. Baird has been honored as the Distinguished Faculty Lecturer, Faculty of Medicine, UBC, has received the YWCA Woman of Distinction Award for Outstanding Contributions to Health and Education, was the Osler Lecturer for the Vancouver Medical Association in 1991. In that year, she also received a Doctorate of Science, honoris causa, from McMaster University, and a Doctor of the University, honoris causa, from the University of Ottawa. In 1992, she was awarded the Order of British Columbia. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Professor Patricia Baird to speak on Proceed with Care, New Reproductive Technologies in Canada.
Well, thank you, Hector. I think it's just as well I'm not going to use the overhead tonight, actually. I'm a great supporter of the Vancouver Institute, so I'm particularly pleased to be here and have the chance to talk about some important issues that face all of us. In my talk tonight, what I want to do is to outline for you what the mandate of the Royal Commission on New Reproductive Technologies was, our methods of work to fulfill that mandate, and then what our recommendations are. I think you'll see by the time I'm finished that that goal means that that's an awful lot of information to cover. So I'm only going to be able to give you the bare bones. But what I would like to say is that the report itself is available in government bookstores, and it's available also in the UBC bookstore. And there are 15 volumes of research that accompany it as well, which are also available. So if anybody is interested in any particular specific aspect, they certainly can have lots of sources to look up further. Now, as this first slide shows, our mandate was very far-reaching. In essence, what we were asked to do is look at a whole range of technologies and practices that relate in some way to reproduction, and then recommend how in Canada we should deal with them. Our mandate included not only things that you usually think of when you say new reproductive technologies, things like donor insemination or in vitro fertilization, IVF, but it also included many other topics, such as prenatal diagnosis, embryo research, and the use of fetal tissue. Now, it's obvious that the matters that are in our mandate raise issues that involve the values of Canadians. So how they are handled must take into consideration those values. We found from our surveys that having children in a healthy family were the most important aspects of their lives for most Canadians. Having children and ensuring they're healthy are such important goals in life for most people that the inability to have children is not a trivial matter. We found that infertility is not a one-time event, but it has effects throughout life. Many landmarks and events in our lives together, the way our social network is constructed, reflect the importance of children. They reflect the connections to the next generation and to a future that many people who are infertile feel cut off. They're constant reminders through the life cycle, for example, as children go to school, children of friends graduate from college, or they marry and have children of their own. This means that the importance of children is such that if there are safe and effective ways of helping people to achieve that goal, Canadians feel that they should be available. At the same time, they're worried about the harms and misuses of reproductive technology, and they want government to ensure that only beneficial use of technology is allowed. We had two main streams to our work. One of them was very wide consultation and input. We tried to reach all sectors, all viewpoints. And by the time we had completed our mandate, more than 40,000 Canadians had participated. The other stream of our work was research and analysis of information and evidence on the technologies. Oh, sorry. Thank you for letting me know. Annette, that's not very good, is it? Okay. Now there we are. That's what I'm talking about now, is the analysis of information and evidence on the technologies. What their current practice and use is, what their social, legal, and ethical implications are. Now, what we did was come to our conclusions in light of this widely based... Yeah, it's not doing that very well. It's still not... Well, excuse me 1 minute. There's a red... help phone. Help, help! Oh, has he? Okay. Well, we'll just See if I can find what I want to next. If I press slowly, maybe. No? Okay, well, by serendipity, this is the one I want to talk about. What we did was... Yes? No, it, when I press, it doesn't do what it's told. It skips or goes twice.
Well, what I'll do is I'll go up there and sit with a slide projector, so you just tell me. Next slide, please.
Okay. Okay, to get back to what we were talking about. What we did was come to our conclusions with these two things in mind, with the widely based input and the evidence from our research program. And we had three considerations in mind when we judged all this input and evidence. And one of these was a set of explicit ethical principles. Another one was our understanding of the values and attitudes espoused by Canadians. And the third thing was a pretty deep conviction that offering any medical procedure as a service must be based on evidence that it works. We found that reproductive technologies are not a monolith. Some technologies require outright prohibition. Some are beneficial and should be supported. And some should be within particular limits. In other words, a blanket moratorium is not an appropriate response. What I'd like to do now is to touch on some of the most important topics and our findings on them. And then after I've done that, I want to talk about what we recommend be done. I think you'll see that as I go through these topics, that each one of them deals with aspects that touch both intimate and social parts of the human condition. So to start with what we found, how common is infertility? You need to know how common it is to make public policy decisions and to follow whether it's increasing or decreasing. Slide, please. We were surprised to find... Slide. Next slide, please. Okay, good. We were surprised to find that, in fact, information on how common infertility was simply wasn't known. The data hadn't been collected in Canada, and we had to do original data collection and research to find out. We now know that 7% of couples in which the woman is between 18 and 44 and who've been cohabiting for 2 years without contraception have not been able to have a pregnancy. Now that translates into 250,000 couples in Canada. And that shows it's an important problem for people, and that's a baseline figure that can now be followed to see if it's going up, going down, or staying the same. Next slide. Next slide, please. Well, I may end up having to do without the slides, mightn't I? Is somebody back there who could please put the next slide on? Doesn't look like it. Okay. I wonder if they'd be better off putting them on another carousel. Anyway. No, that's not what I want. That's not the next slide. Okay. Anyway, an immediately obvious response to infertility is to prevent it if possible. So we needed to know the causes of infertility to see what recommendations were appropriate about prevention. Now, one of the most striking aspects of our investigation was the lack of definitive knowledge in this area. The immediate physiological cause of infertility is quite often known. For example, if it's an ovulation disorder in the woman or abnormal sperm characteristics in the man, that can quite often be told. But identifying the underlying reason for those occurring is often difficult or impossible to determine. That's not the slide I want. Well, okay, that's the slide I want. This is going to be hard, huh? Okay. What I was in the middle of trying to say is that you can often tell whether it's a low sperm count or if it's an ovulation disorder, but why those exist, it's often impossible or difficult to determine. Because the risk factors that lead to infertility are often interrelated and they're often complex. The fertility of an individual is influenced by many considerations, such as exposure to sexually transmitted diseases, to smoking, to age, or to the an exposure to various agents in the workplace. And then when you have two people who come together to try to conceive a child, each of them brings with them their history of exposures to those various factors at different times and different places over the course of their lives. Now, if we could have the next slide, please. And the next one after that. Thank you. Nevertheless, the three most important factors that we identified in terms of evidence being available, that they are both causative and that there are strategies to prevent them, are sexually transmitted diseases, smoking, delaying childbearing. We found, for example, that 20% of cases in clinics are due to sexually transmitted diseases leading to blocked fallopian tubes. Next slide. Wow. Adoption. Adoption is a subject that we examine because it's always suggested as an alternative for infertile couples. We found that, in fact, adoption is a disappearing option. And it's no longer a realistic alternative for many. There are fewer than half the number of infants available for adoption today than there were 10 years ago. Many public adoption agency waiting lists are closed. 8 couples are waiting to adopt for every infant adopted in Canada in 1991, when a total of about 1,700 were adopted. Now, that means that a different light is therefore thrown on other methods to assist people to form a family. Next slide. Next topic we looked at was fertility drugs. Now, these are a treatment that may work if the problem is with ovulation. And these hormones to bring about ovulation are quite commonly prescribed. The use isn't recorded, so we don't know how many children are born as a result of fertility drugs, and there are also, therefore, not good data regarding the long-term consequences for the health of the women or children. We found at some centers that unproven high-dose drug regimes are being offered as treatment. Next slide. Donor insemination. This is an option when there's no fertile male partner. And it's the next most common way to have help after fertility drugs to have a pregnancy. It does mean that the child has another biological father than the male in that couple, and that's the reason some couples prefer not to have this. But it's a safe, inexpensive, and effective way to have a child, provided that standards are followed. Unfortunately, we found that they're not. Because of poor record keeping, it isn't possible to say precisely, but donor insemination probably leads to the birth of several thousand children each year in this country, something just under 1% of all children born. It's done both at clinics and in the offices of physicians. Guidelines are not followed, even at clinics, and sperm where the donor has not been tested for AIDS is used in some instances. Medical and social information on the donor is needed. It's very important for the recipient and for the child to have, but it's not routinely collected. We've learned, in fact, from the experience of adoptees, that nothing is known about a biological parent, it often poses difficulties for that person's sense of identity. People feel as if they started their life as at chapter 2, as one person put it. We found across the country that there was great variation in what, if any, information was collected, and great variation in the length of time it's collected. That means that there's no assurance of limits on the numbers of offspring from one particular donor, or that individuals who are half-siblings may not marry. In spite of the development and publication of standards and of guidelines about donor insemination by the profession some years ago, this is still the situation. As I mentioned, the reason donor insemination is used is because there's no fertile male partner. Unless there's evidence that the well-being of resulting children will be harmed, we recommended that DI should be equally available to all women. To do otherwise contravenes the Charter and the principle of equality. There's never any medical indication for donor insemination. Any use of it is because a woman doesn't have a fertile male partner and is a social indication. Single or lesbian women wishing to form a family this way will not be a very large number, but they should not be denied access for reasons of sexual orientation per se. The available evidence, and we looked at everything that was available, does not show different outcomes in children born to or raised by lesbians or single women when compared to children born to heterosexual women or to couples in similar circumstances. Thus, the best interests of the child cannot be used as a reason to deny access, but we found that lesbian or single women were usually turned away. Next slide. The least common strategy used to overcome infertility is in vitro fertilization, or so-called test tube babies, where the egg and the sperm are brought together outside the body, and then the resulting zygote is transferred to the uterus in the hope that pregnancy will occur. This is only done in specialized centers, and in 1991, less than 400 children were born following its use. We found that the data to allow its proper evaluation of the success rate, for example, is not collected, and that there is incomplete and often misleading information given to women considering the procedure. The technique is expensive and it involves certain health risks. There are different categories of indication in which it can be used, for example, for blocked tubes, or for unexplained infertility, or, for example, for mild endometriosis. But we evaluated the data very carefully, and it has not been proven to increase the likelihood of pregnancy compared to no treatment, except in that category of cases where a woman's fallopian tubes are blocked. It offers couples where that is the case an increased probability over no treatment of having a child, but only somewhat less than half the time in Canada is it used for that category of indication. From an up-to-date review and analysis of the data from the world literature, we found that IVF for other categories is unproven. That's not the same as saying it doesn't work. The data simply do not allow you to make the conclusion that it works. Yet, it's offered as a treatment without the protections that being categorized as research entails, such as review by an ethics board, full information to the woman so she knowingly consents, not paying for it as a service. If it's offered for these other categories, and it's appropriate that there be clinical trials for those categories, then it should be with proper data collection and with fully informed consent in the context of clinical trials. Of concern is that it's possible to use all these technologies in a growing and widening variety of circumstances. For example, to allow a woman to embark on and carry a pregnancy so she can hand over the infant to a commissioning couple who pay her. The going rate is around $15,000. And these are so-called surrogacy or preconception arrangements. Next slide, please. Our review on the evidence about this is in fact disturbing. These arrangements commodify reproduction and children. We found that commissioning couples have much higher incomes and are more highly educated than the women undertaking the pregnancies. These arrangements have the potential to exploit women's vulnerability because of poverty, because of race or powerlessness, and they leave women open to coercion. A woman who does this can't win. If she denies her emotional response during the intimate and deeply human experience of pregnancy and birth, she's dehumanized. If, on the other hand, she becomes attached to the child, it results in grief and loss. Non-commercial arrangements still present the potential for coercion in the form of family pressure to participate. And even if the motivation is sincere and generous, it's offensive to the human dignity of children to conceive them specifically to hand over to someone else. We felt that a woman's ability to have a pregnancy and birth should not be alienable. It should not be used for someone else. We recognize that arrangements that are private without intermediaries can't be stopped, but the interests of children need protection in that situation. Other examples of the widening ways that reproductive technology is being used include using IVF to allow a woman in her 60s and past normal menopause to have a child using an egg taken from a younger woman. Also, it's now possible to freeze fertilize eggs and zygotes and keep them, freeze them for long enough that if you wished, you could implant them into another generation. On the horizon is the possibility that eggs from aborted fetuses could be matured and fertilized and implanted. The list of widening possibilities goes on. There's no legislation regarding commercial activities in this field in Canada, and we found that women are in fact undertaking preconception arrangements for money. There are several commercial for-profit sperm banks, and there are two clinics where you can pay to have sperm treated to try to select the sex of your child. Next slide. We've seen vividly from south of the border what happens when the market is left to decide what's available. If you want to hire a woman to have your embryo implanted, you can. And postmenopausal women can pay to have a younger woman's egg implanted. Recently in the United States, a woman rented a billboard to advertise womb for rent. That is in fact true, it's not just made up. So going on to the topics that we considered, the next slide, with regard to embryo research. Some knowledge about reproduction that's particularly relevant to the treatment of infertility can only be gained by research observing fertilization and early development of the embryo under different conditions. For example, what's the best culture medium to keep eggs in so that when you add the sperm, they fertilize and they start cleaving normally? Only if you keep eggs in different solutions and then observe them when they fertilize can you know that. So that some research is essential in ensuring the safety and quality of medical treatment in the field. At the same time, it's essential to ensure that zygotes are treated with respect because of their connections to the human community. Boundaries and regulation are needed, but we found there's no legal or public policy on embryo research in Canada. Next slide, prenatal diagnosis. All of us take a risk of a few percent that a child will have a serious congenital anomaly or genetic disease. Some people have a greater risk than most of us because of their family history or their age. Now, we found that a large majority of Canadians think that prenatal diagnosis should be available to those individuals, and about three-quarters of Canadians say they'd use it themselves if they were in that higher risk situation. Prenatal diagnosis provides choices for at-risk couples, It allows them to have healthy children, and if it's used for serious disorders with fully informed consent, it's beneficial. But there are risks if it's misused. We found a problem in the referral network of physicians who refer for prenatal diagnosis. Women's attitudes to wishing to have prenatal diagnosis if they're at risk varied very little across the country. Most say that they would use it. On the other hand, we found that physicians' attitudes varied markedly in different regions, and we found there was a fourfold difference in likelihood an eligible woman would be referred, which correlated with that. That's disturbing because the choice to use prenatal diagnosis or not should be made by the woman, not by the physician. Evaluation of prenatal diagnosis technologies should be done before they become disseminated as services. Yet, for example, routine prenatal ultrasound costs around $100 million annually in this country, and yet it's not been proven to have benefit in terms of outcomes. Cooperation and evaluation of genetic technologies before they're funded and widely used is therefore important and needed. It's important particularly because more and more conditions are becoming amenable to diagnosis, and we will need to decide which are appropriate to offer publicly supported services for, and wide-based public input into that process will be needed. Canadians are fearful that genetics will be misused. They want to know what's being done in genetics. It's an area of concerns and one that they want to be open and transparent in decision making. And that leads us into the area of sex selection, that is, selecting the sex of offspring simply because one sex is preferred over the other. I'm not referring to the situation here where there's a disorder in the family that affects only males. Next slide. There are three ways that you can select sex. The first one is prenatal diagnosis by amniocentesis, that's tapping into the womb, by chorionic villus biopsy, or by detailed ultrasound. Now, these can be done after 10 weeks of pregnancy, and then the fetus of the undesired sex can be aborted. It violates the principle of respect for human life and dignity, as well as other ethical principles. Mechanisms to control or discourage this are lacking. Although most Canadians wouldn't use it, there are some ethnic communities where males are valued more highly, and pregnant women could be pressured to undergo this kind of sex selection. The second way of selecting sex is to, in fact, do IVF. So you've got the zygote in your hand, then take one of the cells of the early zygote and you test it to see if it's XX or XY, and then only implant into the uterus those that are the desired sex. That's invasive, it's expensive, it's wasteful of medical resources, and it shows a lack of respect for human life, even if it's at a very early stage. The third method is treating sperm with the aim of enhancing either the X-bearing sperm or the Y-bearing sperm. And that doesn't violate the respect for human life, but it is intrusive. Several cycles are usually needed on average because you've got to have the sperm, you've got to treat the sperm, and therefore you've got to do insemination of the woman. It's not very efficient. With each cycle, there's only about a 10% chance of having a live birth. And by using the technique, instead of being 50-50 whether you'll have a girl or a boy, you can get it up to somewhere around 70-30. Contrary to what the case certainly is in some other countries, our research surveys across Canada found that the great majority of Canadians don't in fact have a gender bias when it comes to the sex of their children. They would only be interested in using sperm treatment to have at least one child of each sex. So to allow sperm treatment in Canada is unlikely to change the sex ratio. But it does reinforce the idea that the sex of a child is important, and that families with all boys or all girls are less than ideal. It could make existing children in a family feel that their own sex is lacking in some way, and what about the kids who are the outcome when it didn't work? Research to determine the effectiveness and safety is not of sufficient value to devote scarce resources to it. For example, does treating the sperm this way lead to more abnormalities? Are there any problems in the children who result? That's simply not been done. But we believe that it's not of sufficient value to devote scarce resources to it, and we believe it shouldn't be, therefore, permitted for sex preference. There's no mechanism currently in place, however, and there are commercial clinics already offering this at $500 a cycle, and they are ready to franchise. Next slide. Several uses of genetic knowledge are relevant to human reproduction. Gene therapy at the somatic level, that means the body cell level, involves inserting a normal gene into the body cells of an individual to correct a genetic disease. Now, use of that approach in children or in adults may be appropriate if it's the only hope for severely affected individuals. If you were to think of doing it in the prenatal context, that is, to a fetus while it was still in utero, then that poses risks to the woman as well as to the developing fetus. And it means that as well as the usual ethical reviews, another level of scrutiny would be desirable. Genetic alteration of the germline, that is the sperm or the egg cells, is something which is quite a different matter, as is non-therapeutic genetic alteration. That is simply doing a genetic alteration to improve or enhance an individual who is already quite healthy. That's quite a different matter. Both of those carry great social and medical risks without any clear benefit to an individual. Now, my final topic, if we get the next slide on, before I tell you what we recommend to deal with all these issues, is the use of fetal tissue. We found that the evidence is that there's a real possibility that the use of fetal tissue transplant could result in considerable alleviation of human suffering in some devastating illnesses. To prohibit pursuit of such research would be uncaring and unethical. But at the same time, because elective abortion provides the only practical source of tissue, there must be controls to ensure that the use of tissue in research does not encourage abortion. No such mechanisms exist in Canada. Next slide, please. I've now touched on the highlights of the topic areas that we examined and some important items of what we found. One final point that I want to make is that the approach that we've recommended be put in place in Canada doesn't contribute to undermining our universal access, publicly supported healthcare system. Our approach to reproductive technologies, that is, that they should be evaluated in research and not put in place as service unless they're proven to work, is in fact an approach that would be helpful if it were to be used more widely in the healthcare system. Could you take that slide back, please? I didn't want it yet. I'd like now to turn to what we recommend be done. It's clear that the situation... Would you please take that slide off? I don't want it yet. Well, never mind, you're getting a preview. I think it should be clear to all of us by now that, in fact, the situation with regard to new reproductive technologies needs to be addressed. The issues are not going to go away, and, in fact, the field is growing, and potential uses and misuses are widening. There are headlines every week or so. The most recent ones have been about the cloning of human embryos, a 63-year-old woman being pregnant after having a young egg implanted, A woman wanting IVF so the child she bears will be a color other than herself, and using eggs obtained from fetuses. It's clear that there are harms both to individuals and to the society from misuse, and that the potential for these is growing. We concluded that the government, as guardian of the public interest, must act to put boundaries around the use of new reproductive technologies and must put in place a system to manage them within those boundaries, not just for now, but importantly in a flexible, responsive, ongoing way. And we therefore recommend two things. And now you can show the slide, please. Thank you. First, we recommend legislation to prohibit, with criminal sanctions, several aspects of new reproductive technologies, such as using zygotes in research related to cloning, animal-human hybrids, ectogenesis, which means growing outside the womb until the child can be independent, the fertilization of eggs from female fetuses for implantation, the sale, any sale of human eggs, zygotes, fetuses, or fetal tissue, and payment for or acting as an intermediary for surrogacy arrangements. We believe that these could be acted on immediately by government, and that the great majority of Canadians want these boundaries. Second, we strongly recommend that the federal government establish a regulatory body with licensing required for the provision of new reproductive technologies to people. We feel that we cannot continue with the present harmful and inequitable patchwork of standards and uses, and Canadians told us that they don't want the market to determine what's available in this country. Only the federal government can set up such a system, and it's important that the government fulfill its responsibility to protect citizens and society by doing so. I must tell you that we came to the need for a national commission rather reluctantly. Could I have the next slide, please? We had hoped to find an already existing home for these responsibilities, but we couldn't find one. Given that these matters are not at root medical matters, this is not a health matter, it's a social matter, it is human reproduction. And we find that the implications of how these technologies are used affect the nature of our society. They reach into law, into workplace policies, into prevention, education, commerce, science, and research policy. Matters that are so important to women and children and family, not only in terms of their health, but in terms of their legal status and how they're viewed, can differ from province to province. For example, if you were to permit paid surrogacy in one province, it promotes a view of reproduction and of children as commodities. That view cannot be contained within provincial boundaries. If you permit 60-year-olds to have IVF in one place but not in others, you'd get reproductive tourism. The examples are many. The field is growing rapidly, and Canadians want the government to protect their interests. It's accepted that regulating radio and TV is necessary to the Canadian public interest. Certainly, the area of reproductive technology is at least as important as television to us, as individuals, and as a society. Next slide. We recommend that a national commission be set up to regulate this field, composed of 12 members, with women normally making up at least half. Membership should include people with a broad range of experiences and perspectives, including perspectives of those with disabilities, those who are infertile, and those who are members of racial minorities. A range of expertise should be represented, including reproductive medicine, ethics, law, and social sciences. We believe that license hearings should be public and that a license should be conditional on complying with certain conditions. The Commission would report annually to Canadians on what was going on in these fields through Parliament. Next slide. We recommended that the National Commission have five areas it regulates where it would be compulsory to have a license to provide these services. And these are in the areas of donor insemination, assisted conception, prenatal diagnosis for genetic disorders and congenital anomalies, research that involves human zygotes, and providing human fetal tissue for research. The major functions in these five areas are similar because what needs to be done is common to all the technologies. Next slide, please. We need to have compliance with standards to collect information on what is going on and to set appropriate policies. In addition to these five subcommittees, we've recommended a sixth subcommittee with primary responsibility in infertility prevention. It would compile and evaluate data on the causes of infertility, promote cooperative research in Canada and internationally, and promote the public education, regulatory, and other options for preventing infertility. If our recommendations are adopted, it would lead to a consistent countrywide system for the regulation of reproductive technologies. Next slide, please. For example, with regard to infertility treatment, a system would be in place to ensure the availability of safe sperm collected with good record keeping needed to provide information for children. IVF and other specialized infertility treatments would be provided in circumstances where reliable information on success rates is disclosed and there's appropriately informed consent and information is collected on outcomes. It would mean that a mechanism was in place to facilitate the multi-center trials and data collection that are needed to assess the safety and effectiveness of the technologies. Our recommendations mean that once safety and effectiveness has been assessed, treatment could be provided by the health system, not by the market, and it would mean that unproven uses would only be available in the context of research. Next slide. Our recommendations would mean that prenatal diagnosis would only be available in licensed facilities so that information could be collected and standards of unbiased, accurate information provision upheld. It would mean that prenatal ultrasound or testing of pregnant women's blood for genetic disease or congenital anomalies in the fetus would only be provided in licensed programs. Implementation of our recommended licensing would assure Canadians that genetic knowledge is applied in human reproduction in an accountable way and within acceptable limits, for example, not being used for sex selection. Our next slide. Our recommendations would require that the provision of fetal tissue for use be licensed. Conditions of license would include that permission be obtained from the woman subsequent to her abortion decision, that there would be no payment involved, the method of abortion could not be changed, that the fetal tissue only be used in research regarding human disease, and that be no benefit to the provider and no designation of recipients. These would all ensure that this use of tissue did not encourage abortion. Our recommendations, next slide, with regard to embryo research, would mean that any research conducted must be in a licensed facility. It would only be permitted within 14 days after fertilization. The goal of research would be knowledge about disease, and there would be no other way of getting that knowledge. Informed consent of the gamete or embryo donors would be needed, and egg retrieval solely for fertilization and then research use would not be permitted. Slide off, please. Lastly, our recommendations would mean that a focus for national action would be in place with regard to infertility prevention. In essence, what we have done is set out a blueprint for how Canada, with its unique institutions and makeup, can deal with new reproductive technologies, can regulate their use, and ensure that future developments are in the public interest. Our blueprint requires leadership and action from the federal government, but it also involves the participation and commitment of provincial governments, professional groups, and other sectors of society. The approach that we're proposing is feasible and it's practical, and we've laid out a detailed plan for how it could be accomplished. The reasons for such action are compelling. The potential for harm to individuals and the need to protect the vulnerable interests of individuals and of society. All of us have a stake in what kind of society we live in. That it not be a community where people and reproduction are commodified and where unethical and harmful use of new technologies is made. Adopting our recommendations will enable this protection, but it will also allow, at the same time, scientific knowledge to be used to better the lives of many Canadians. I believe that implementing the blueprint would demonstrate that we care about each other's well-being and that we recognize the importance that people attach to having children. It would ensure that only ethical and accountable use of technologies is made, and it would demonstrate that we have the wisdom, humanity, and compassion in the way that we choose to use technology. We've done our work at the Commission, and we've indicated the path that we believe should be taken. And it's now up to the government and up to the people of Canada to decide if they will take it. I hope they do. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Baird will now take questions. She'll repeat the question so the rest of the audience can hear it.
I should like to ask, have you had an indication yet of the attitudes of provincial governments toward your proposals?
When we were still doing our work, we consulted with a number of provincial governments, and some of the feedback we got was that they were quite receptive to exploring a common approach. I think they, too, are cognizant of the fact that it's not very easy to contain these within provincial boundaries. The federal government obviously would want to consult very closely with provincial governments, and next week, I know that the Deputy Ministers of Health and the federal people are meeting in Toronto, and they've asked me to come and give a presentation. Exactly what the response will be, I don't know. The lady behind there, yeah.
Since sexually transmitted diseases seems to be such a blockage, we should have more public education and then more reporting.
Yeah, the comment was that since sexually transmitted diseases seem to be an important cause here, perhaps there should be more public education. That, in fact, is one of our recommendations, and we've recommended some quite specific ways in which that could be done. It's very, very important. I think young people, particularly young women, may close off their options for fertility, never realizing that they've done so. Chlamydia, in particular, is an infection that can be silent. They can have no symptoms and yet can end up with blocked tubes because of that. So it's very important that if people are going to have sexual partners more than one, not only do they need to have contraception, but they need to have condoms as well to protect against sexually transmitted diseases. Yes?
You mentioned that a woman who consents to have her fetus used for research should not be paid. Now, there has been a somewhat similar case already quite a few years ago where a man with a blood condition, his spleen was removed and a cell line was developed that was in tissue culture that was used for therapeutic purposes in other patients. And if I remember correctly, the man went to court to ask his share in the profits of his cell lines. and as far as I recollect, he won. So if a woman would make her fetus available for research and a profitable result would come out of it, what would prevent her from going to court and ask her share in that?
Yes, the question was that there was a court case not very long ago in which a man's spleen that had been removed, a cell line was developed which was profitable, and he went to court wishing to have a share of the profits. If there were to be a cell line developed from a fetus, what is to prevent a woman wishing to have a share of that? The case that you're referring to is the case of Moore. And in fact, when the man sued, he did not get a share of the profits. The ruling was that the physician who should disclose any vested interest he has in removing that spleen, that, for example, if there was a potential that it be used to develop something which is a profit, that should be disclosed to the person from whom it's removed. The whole issue of patenting of cell lines is a very complex and difficult one, and we have addressed that in a whole chapter of the report. One of the things that we have said is that fetal tissue should never be sold. The issue of patent protection and how that should be viewed is a very complex one, and we've addressed that in quite some detail. Yes, we did, and we have a long discussion of that. That is obviously the moral status of when a human life exists, to which one has moral obligations, and what the degree of moral obligations is a question that is viewed differently by many people. I think that we have taken a position on that for very clear reasons, which we lay out, and we feel that right from the very beginning, obviously there is an entity that is worthy of respect because it is connected to the human community by its past and potentially by its future. That does not mean that, in fact, it has the full rights and we have the full obligations to it at that stage that we do for a live-born human being.
Why not?
It would take me the rest of the evening if I were to go ahead with that, yes?
With regard to IVF, are there any value judgments you would use to rule out some women as being suitable? For example, somebody who had two previous children apprehended by social services or an abusive household or so.
We left it open that there may be specific circumstances which a physician in good conscience would not wish to use IVF, but they should not be discriminatory per se. For example, it may be that a woman with a particular sexual orientation, that per se should not be used. The whole situation needs to be assessed. Yeah? The position we took on that was that, in fact, for a woman of that age to have a pregnancy means that resources that are fairly scarce have to be used. An egg has to be obtained from a younger woman, and so that involves risk to that younger woman. The medical resources available should not be driven by the market. That means that this should be available if it's a safe and effective procedure within the healthcare system. We feel that there are far greater calls of priority for those eggs and for those scarce medical resources in women who are at an age when it's normally a function to be able to be pregnant. Therefore, we recommended that women past the normal age of menopause not be recipients of eggs. Yes, I think that the question you raise as to whether there are environmental and other agents which are in fact affecting fertility is an extremely important question for the future of the human species. One of the very interesting pieces of research work was a study of sperm counts over the last 50 years, for example, which found that they've dropped by roughly half in many countries in the Western world. That, I think, is a very disturbing finding. It means that the question is an important one. The answers are not very clear. And we spent a great deal of time in our report addressing that. For example, there are a number of agents that people are exposed to in the environment and in the workplace that if they're exposed to them in sufficient doses, beyond doubt, it can cause infertility. But whether the kinds of doses that people are exposed to, which are very, very small from usual environmental exposures, in fact cause infertility, we simply don't know. We've made some very specific recommendations about the importance of research and how it should be structured. These kinds of questions don't just face Canada. They face every nation. And that's why we've recommended that, in fact, Canada should work with the United Nations to try and get some international cooperation on this, where perhaps different countries could address certain kinds of agents and we could set some priorities as to how we could approach this. Very important question. The back. Yes, there is, and it's all detailed in the final report. Basically, as women get older, the fertility decreases until it goes at menopause. So that if you're trying to have a child later, in your late 30s or early 40s, then it's very likely to take quite a bit longer to become pregnant, and it's possible that in fact it may not happen if you wait too long. By having children later, if someone is healthy in that they're not heavy smokers, they've not been exposed to a whole range of problems, it's likely that with good medical care and looking after themselves, the outcome will be very good. But there is an increased risk of chromosome abnormalities in the child, of certain kinds of problems in the pregnancy, so that the risk taken is higher. It's several times higher than in a woman in her 20s, but the absolute magnitude of that risk, even though it is many times higher, is still low with good care. So the outlook for most older women who are pregnant is good. Does that answer your question? Yeah, the statistics are all laid out in that chapter of our thing. Yeah.
This question isn't a statement, but I'll have to read it. Canada isn't one of the clear technology developed to lead the world to increase technology. However, it is presently formed, reported on a mental reading, and Trump can't let it lift. Responsible for it.
I'm not exactly sure what that was, except that I think it was saying, why wasn't the electronic form available? The commission reports to government, which we did, and then there's a group of government called Canada Communications that looks after the publication and the dissemination and the electronic forms of it. We recommended highly to them that be done and be made available. It's totally out of my control, or it's nothing to do with the commission itself. It's government that decides those things. I mean, I agree with you. 100%. I think it should be widely disseminated in electronic form, and we in fact asked for that. Whether Canada Communications will do it, I just don't know. Yes.
We expect a lot of reproductive tourism to the United States, and will that not turn a whole lot of otherwise law-abiding citizens into criminals?
The question was, if our recommendations are implemented, would that not lead to a lot of people going across the border to the United States and turning them into criminals? Well, okay. I think that we have a very long and we have a very leaky border with the United States. And I think it's very evident that there the market is driving policy in this particular area. I think that's a very dangerous situation for our social future. And I think that that doesn't mean that because they are having a laissez-faire attitude that we in Canada should. One of the things that is valuable to most Canadians about living in Canada is the fact that we care for each other and that we have a different social system here. I think that what is important that we put in place, get our own house in order, and then that we work internationally with other countries to try and get some kind of global ethic, some kind of international ethic. This is not a range of issues that is going to go away. These are issues that are facing all societies, and I think there is a real need to ensure that there are some international agreements about this, and I think that points up the need for this. The person in the hat. I'm sorry? Fourteen day, because we did that because that is the stage at which the zygote has, usually it's the time at which it's normally completed implantation in the uterus. It's also the first point at which you can see if there's going to be an embryo proper developed there or not, or whether there's going to be one, two, or none. It's also the stage at which most countries have, from a purely practical point of view, said, look, this makes sense in pluralistic societies where there are pros and cons, that this is an appropriate guideline. And so there are a whole range of reasons, which we go into in the report, for why we chose that, but those are basically the reasons.
As a follow-on question to the one that was asked by the gentleman down here, is there any provision in either the original free trade agreement or now in NAFTA that would limit the ability of Canadian governments to put constraints on the market getting into this area?
Not that we found. Oh, repeat the question. Does the speaker wanted to know if NAFTA was likely to circumscribe what we could do in this country?
Either NAFTA or the original FTA, because it's still in force.
Yeah. As far as we could tell, no. It would not impinge on this. Uh, this is something which we discussed, and we felt that most women do have terminations with regret, and they have them usually for good reasons. They're not usually things that are done trivially or lightheartedly, and that woman should therefore have the opportunity to say what happens to the fetal tissue. Yeah? The role of physicians should be as partners to make sure that they offer to patients, you think, saying in the area of providing reproductive technology. I'm not really clear on your question.
If the federal government agrees and goes along with the provincial government with all the recommendations.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. By their professionals across the border, how are we going to relate to that and to control it a little bit and to make it happen in this country and be a role model for other countries?
I think the question was how would physicians relate to the licensing scheme in this area? I mean, obviously, physicians are very integrally involved. They'll be essential partners, and one would expect that they would have a lot of opportunity for input. I think it's evident that the implications of use or non-use of these technologies are really social and ethical, and physicians are no better equipped to make those kinds of decisions than other people in society. And that's why it's essential that whatever the decision-making and policy-setting mechanisms are, they include a very wide base of input, including physicians. Yeah. How are we doing?
1 minute.
Okay. One more question at the. Okay.
Has the study addressed the medical ethics of our Canadian multicultural society that may or may not agree with the recommendations? I'm focusing on some cultures which prefer one sex.
The question was how have we taken into account the multicultural nature of Canada and the fact that there may be some subcultures or some communities that feel differently, for example, about sex selection than the majority of Canadians. We go into that in quite some detail again in the final report. We feel that there are certain fundamental values which, in fact, in Canada we should subscribe to. And sexual equality is one of them. And we feel that to say, okay, this particular subculture doesn't subscribe to that, therefore that's okay, we'll respect them and we'll say that's okay for you. We feel that that is inappropriate. That in fact there is the fundamental nature of certain values is such that these are should be subscribed to if someone wishes to live in Canada. Yeah.
One last question.
You arrived at all these requirements.
I think they want to go.
One last question.
Okay. No, it's obviously it's very, very difficult. They are very difficult and complex issues, and there's a lot of evidence to weigh and a lot of different opinions. What we did was go through the ethical principles and foundation that we laid out and judge each one in terms of that, not only in terms of how the principles were affected, but the different groups of individuals were affected. And apart from that, all I can say is it's difficult, and we worked through the process, and I think we've come up with a very good product which makes sense and is, I hope, going to be useful to Canada.
Before I call on Professor Jan Friedland, the head of medical genetics, to thank our speaker, I'd like to announce another lecture that she is giving this week in IRC, this building, Lecture Hall 4, 12:30 on Wednesday, February 23rd, making decisions about the new reproductive technology, NRT, an ethical framework. This is the Dr. John F. McCreary lecture, and you're all welcome to come to that. Now I'd like to ask Professor Friedland to thank our speaker.
I was asked to say thanks, and I thought that would take me about 1 second, but I see my responsibilities a little greater. First of all, I'd like to thank the audience for their attention and their very thoughtful questions, which have added greatly to our enjoyment of the evening. Second of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Baird for her lucid and challenging presentation, which stimulated all of this discussion. But I think most importantly, I'd like to thank Dr. Baird for her dedication and tenacity to this issue and for her pursuit of the Royal Commission, which really has done a very great service to all of us as Canadians. Thank you.